Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In.
You have always been a voice of reason through all of this.
Appreciate your time, what you're doing for America.
I give you advice, and it doesn't work at all.
You are definitely not inept by any means.
I like to hear women say that about me.
Whatever advice you're going to send my way, I am 100% taking it.
I can't tell you what to do. I will not tell you what to do.
Okay. Well, thanks.
That wasn't the answer I wanted.
Are you kidding me?
Great stuff, Dr. Ray. I'm glad I called.
I've scheduled my day around listening to your radio show.
You don't have to laugh so hard.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Broadcasting in high-definition radio, using words like pulchritudinous, mellifluous, verisimilitude, pugnacious, serendipitous, big, long, polysyllabic words in the lexicon, sprinkled throughout high-definition radio. Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor's In. Monday variant, E-Person Monday. Some years ago, I had to do something because many, many people, and some of this is coming from the TV show, many people, what TV show, you say? Well, I have a TV show with EWTN called Living Right with Dr. Ray. It's in its 14th season coming up. We're taping now for 14th season. I got a lot of emails coming in, sometimes more email than calls. I had to do something to address some of those emails. Now, a certain percentage of them are saying, do you know anybody in such and such an area that might respect my Catholic view if I go to them as a therapist? I give them certain websites they can pursue. And one of the big things is if they have a local Catholic radio affiliate, call the affiliate people. They oftentimes know of very faith-filled, respecting of the Catholic worldview therapists. So I'd say that's maybe 20%. 20% of the e-persons. Get some just making comments. Get some that say, hey, I heard that call. Consider this. That's that. Probably the bulk, maybe 50% of them, are here's my situation type e-persons. So given that, I'll do my best to get through them. Now, oftentimes I will suggest that the writer calls because I can ask a lot of questions and I talk a lot faster than I type. Right now, just to type this right now, as I read this off right now, would have taken me about a minute and a half. If they don't call in, then I try to address the email on the air. But again, there's a certain natural falling behind. G.K. Chesterton said something to this effect. The one doctrine of Christianity that has abundant evidence is the doctrine of original sin, fallen nature. Christians who attempt to live the Christian life understand that something about our nature is awry. We are bent toward the self. We are stubbornly self-protective. We have to fight off our impulses, our desire to put ourselves ahead of others. All kinds of things come from our fallen human nature, our sin nature. And Christians understand this. Therefore, it is perplexing from the perspective of a believing Christian to be so quick to call their child strong-willed or defiant or unruly or difficult or challenging. By the way, difficult child is redundant. I think that reflects buying into psychological terminology more than Christian understanding. If someone says to me, oh, my three-year-old is so defiant, what do you think's wrong? I'll say, well, from a psychological developmental perspective, most likely nothing is wrong. from a Christian perspective, he's like the rest of us. He's got fallen human nature. What do you expect? He is self-focused. The world revolves around me. And that is part and parcel of raising children all the way through. It's part and parcel of us raising children. The most, I believe, frequent adjective thrown at kids is strong-willed. I cannot tell you how many parents I talk to, especially those who are having difficult times with their discipline, who will call their children strong-willed. Now, I've noticed that strong-willed is generally, well, I shouldn't say generally, often not enough. It has to be modified. He is extremely strong-willed. She is so strong-willed. She is exceptionally strong-willed. The indication is that there's something about this child who makes them more likely to challenge authority or rules or limits or expectations. Yeah, there is. Fallen nature. Oh, Dr. Ray, I have four children, and my one son is much more challenging than the other three. I understand. Doesn't necessarily mean he's strong-willed. It means he is stronger-willed than his siblings. My wife and I have had 10 children who were adopted, as some of you listening to the show might know. And some of them had very, very bad histories, especially the children we adopted older. Drug and alcohol exposure in the womb, low birth weights, heavy drugs before and after birth, neglect. Things that would, in fact, make these kids more of a challenge, because they either had histories that were fragmented or they had neurology that was battered in the womb and shortly thereafter. Did I consider any of my kids strong-willed? No. That sounds dumb. It's like this guy's had one too many kids, you know? He's one toke over the line, sweet Moses. I think there's a simple explanation. Yeah, did they vary in strength of will or willing to challenge? Yeah, of course they did. But none of them was stronger willed than their mother. And I think from a Christian perspective, we've really lost sight of that is the natural course of kids to push, to see what they can get away with. This does not mean they're evil creatures. It just means it's who we are from birth. And that's why they need strong parents to socialize a whole lot of this stiff-neckedness away. Some kids challenge more than others. I got it. Remember James Dobson, Dr. James Dobson? He was the elite of the family psychologists, at least media-wise. Dobson wrote a book called The Strong-Willed Child, and it was Dobson's contention that there are these kids that just, oh, they're just like this, you know, they're strong-willed. And I remember thinking, but wait, stubborn will is part of the human condition because of our fall. So how much stubborn will do you have before somebody says you're strong-willed? I think it's better to say he's normal-willed. Dr. Ray, you are underestimating. You are trivializing. You are bypassing the fact that some kids do push harder than others. No, I'm not. Recognize that totally. What I'm saying is there are many, many children who are not strong-willed but are getting the label. And part of it is because people, almost by osmosis, have bought into the notion that children are naturally cooperative, that they want to get along. They want to listen. You know, parents will say, he doesn't listen. What they're saying is, yeah, he's not following my instructions or my guidance with my words. Yes, because his strength of will that he's gotten from birth, that's part of all of us, overwhelms persuasion much of the time. So, the idea that so many kids are strong-willed comes from two places. One, Christians especially have forgotten that fallen human nature makes stiff necks and bent will toward the self. That's one. And two, the onslaught of the shrinks have basically convinced parents that children are naturally compliant, naturally cooperative, and if you just use the right words and the right reasoning and the right logic and the right sticker system, this child will be so ever grateful to get along. Well, you may get some like that, but that's not the general rule. Strong-willed is the most overused adjective applied to our children. Okie doke. I'm taking a look at the phone scroll here. When we come back, I'll see what's gone on with the e-persons.
What would you do if you were stuck in one place and every day was exactly the same and nothing that you did mattered?
I don't know.
The doctor is in.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Have you ever thought about what you want written on your gravestone? We think about how we want others on earth to remember us, but perhaps our focus should be how God sees us. How we communicate in life impacts the conversations we'll have with God in death. Will we be remembered as bold communicators? I've been bold and sometimes outright aggressive in my talk, but without holiness, the boldness can come off as berating. Without holiness in our hearts, how can good commentary pass through our lips? How we speak can equate to how we live. I wrote about my dad's funeral shortly after he died in 2002. He didn't die a rich man or a famous man, but he died a good man, a faithful man, one ready to meet God the Father. His faith is what I remember most. In life, my dad communicated kindness and love. That kindness and love will always be remembered by those who knew him well. This has been a Christ Center Communication Message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Very nice to have you join me on The Doctor Is In. This is the Monday variant of The Doctor Is In. This is E-Person Monday, where I am scoping into the phone here. Dear Dr. Ray, do you have any advice for how I can get my mom to understand? I always get nervous when somebody says, how do I get somebody to understand my perspective? Oh, there's a whole lot of factors in that one, but that's a tough thing to do if they do not agree with your perspective. Any advice for how I can get my mom to understand that my best option for a good, healthy, fulfilled life is to move out of California? My family and I live in Santa Barbara, which is one of the nicer coastal cities in the state, but it's still suffering from the same problems, as I see it, as the rest of the state. As of this writing, I feel that here my life is empty. I have nothing of value going on. I have a job, which helps pay my bills, but it isn't enough. I haven't been to church in many years due to a combination of the allure of Sunday, I'm assuming he means the freedom that he fills his Sundays with, and the fact that the parish my family has been going to didn't give me a good catechesis. The only prayer I learned was the Hail Mary. I'll stop there. I hear this from a lot of folks. I wasn't taught this. I wasn't given that. I wasn't shown this. Rare is it so deficient, the catechism is so deficient, that you didn't learn some of the basics of the faith. You may have learned a lot of ushy-gushy, feel-good, socially syrupy stuff, but there was decent stuff mixed in. I wasn't taught about the saints or the role they play. I wasn't taught about what makes us different from Protestants or Orthodox Christians. I wasn't taught about why we switched from the Tridentine Mass to Novus Ordo. I wasn't even taught about mental prayer. That's a pretty shaded remembrance, recollection. I can't believe that however many years he went, whether it was to CCD, whether it was, in fact, Catholic school. I imagine it was CCD because he didn't mention going to Catholic schools. That there wasn't some of that, and it may be, and this has been my experience, that a lot of people don't remember it. I'll just give you an example that I use. Where I am, we had to have, in middle school, Ohio history. We had a year of Ohio history. When somebody says to me, I wasn't taught anything about the faith when I was in CCD, or sometimes they'll say when I was in Catholic high school or when I was in Catholic school. They'll say that. I got nothing. I'll ask. If they're from Ohio, I'll say, did you go to school in Ohio? Yes. Well, then you had to have Ohio history. In the eighth grade is when I had it. You had a year of it. Full year of Ohio history. Tell me what you remember. I remember stuff. Okay, what do you remember? Ohio's a state? Okay, that's a start. What else? Well, when did it become a state? Oh, long time ago. Long time ago. My point is, at some level, you do have to be open to whatever is coming in that may be good and solid. And all too often, we look back on it and say, I didn't get this, I didn't get that, I didn't get this. And part of it, not saying all of it, and I'm not saying there wasn't weak catechesis, but part of it was that we were not really interested or open to it. Because of our age, because of our distracting interests. I'm going to skip through a lot of what he said, but the gist of it is, I think I can get a fresh start somewhere else, and I'm willing to try a new parish. I've tried explaining this to my mother, even pointing out that I hope the new parish is one that sets up parishioners together. Because I know she still wants grandkids from me. In other words, what he's saying is, I'd like to meet someone. He's 32. She's worried about what'll happen if I move, because not every state has the range of services that California has. Tri-Counties Regional, Pathpoint, and Independent Living Institute, to be exact. But those services haven't been able to give me the support I need. Okay, I'm reading between the lines here that Mom thinks that our letter writer has some kinds of developmental complications. He wants to be free. He wants to be on his own. She's thinking, I don't believe you can make this because you have struggled. You have certain developmental matters that would make this much more difficult for you. And if you don't get the support you need, it's going to be trouble. I'm reading between the lines on this. Also, I don't know if these agencies can help me because they're not used to clients who want to move out of state. Additionally, I speculate that these services may have created a dependency in me. Okay, he is now acknowledging that, in fact, he is using state services for whatever developmental issues there might be here. Maybe I'll do just fine where I absolutely have to be able to press on. I look forward to your response. Well, see, what I don't know is why mom is resistant to this 32-year-old moving out of state and perhaps out of her supervision. And perhaps does he even live with her or the family? And how extensive is the developmental issues? So that's what I don't know, if that is what is fueling mom's reluctance. To the question of how will I make her understand, well, it sounds like she won't. It sounds like her view is you're not capable of doing this, and you will run into all kinds of problems regarding this. I got enough time? Yeah, oh, if I start it. Okay, I'm going to start this, but I'm probably going to cut off by the break. I'm 27 years old, married with children. However, every time, well, okay, now be careful when you use every time. It's like using always or never. But it must reflect a frequency that he's real uncomfortable with. Every time I see my parents or my grandparents, they boss me around or treat me like I'm a child. My wife has told them, quote, "We don't come in your house and do this to you. Please don't come into our house and do it to us." But they got upset. And they got into a verbal altercation with my wife about it. Doesn't matter what the situation is, they treat me like I'm a child. Now, I'm assuming that he's referring to the fact that they're quick to give advice, they're quick to give opinions, they're quick to maybe critique the decisions he makes. Parenting, my choice of employment, my housework, demanding I help them with their yard work. How can I set a boundary that still shows Christian love for my spouse as well as my parents while asserting my adulthood and my spouse and my family separate from them when they ask or demand or criticize my family's adult choices in their own lives? Well, in some respects, that's pretty straightforward. You kind of nod and you listen and then you do what you want. You don't like them doing that because you don't like what it indicates in your mind, which is, quote, "They're treating me like a child." They may just be opinionated, or they may have their demands on how you should behave, but that's irrelevant. These things are your decisions. I suppose you could tell them, "Mom, this is my decision. I got to do what I think's best." You could do that. And it sounded like when your mom approached, or your wife approached it that way, they got upset. They didn't like hearing that they couldn't tell you what they think. So probably the best way to deal with this is just to kind of stare at them. Don't argue with them. To give their advice. "I don't think you should be working there. There's other places you could be working." "Good for me now, Mom." "Well, it's not good for you now. I don't think it's good for you now." "Well, Mom, that's how you see it." In other words, you're not going to argue with them. Because you can do what you want. That's not dishonoring them. You're not arguing with them, you're not putting them down, not yelling at them, you're just simply nodding and saying, "Okay, that's your opinion. Thank you for it. But don't get so upset by thinking they're just treating me like a child." Eh, you're not a child, and however they act doesn't mean you're a child. Thank you for joining me. This is Dr. Ray. This is The Doctor Is In, Monday through Friday, a co-production of the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, as well as Ave Maria Radio Communications. Handling the board right now is Eric Dumont, who also doubles as my call screamer when we take your calls throughout the week. Hello, Dr. Ray. My oldest child is almost six. She is high-spirited. Okay, now again, this is interesting. This dovetails with my opening monologue, where I talked about how we see kids with certain personality characteristics that are not unusual given fallen human nature, but we tend to speak as though they are out of the realm of the norm. So if you say somebody's high-spirited, that means they are beyond normal-spirited. Okay. She can be very theatrical with the way she speaks and acts. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. You can be dramatic. When parents say theatrical, sometimes they mean, and I haven't read the rest of this for a while, so I'm going to speculate on what the rest of it might say. Sometimes they mean she becomes emotionally disrespectful. We'll find out. Lately, she's been making up a lot of stories. Well, now, this is her getting in touch with her inner drama queen. Almost as if she doesn't differentiate reality and what's made up. In one of my books, I talk about this. I talk about kids fabricating these wild stories. Mom, today, okay, what happened was, you're not going to believe this, somebody's dog got loose and was running in the hallways, and I was the one who chased it out of the building. Yeah, the other kids were scared because it was a big dog, but I wasn't scared. I ran after that dog, and I said, get out of here. They tell these self-aggrandizing stories. And the parents oftentimes think, do they really believe what they're saying? Do they actually think? Is there some kind of fantasy bleeding into a loss of contact with reality? And that seems to be a little bit what Mom is saying. She goes on to say, almost as if she doesn't differentiate reality and what's made up. We talk about what is real and what is not, such as when we're reading or watching something. She makes up things like, oh yeah, we're moving to Florida. Or, yeah, I broke my arm. And even, it's my birthday today. On a random day. What the heck, you get some presents, you know, do that 6-8 times a month. All of these are not true in any regard. Okay, so now, how do I do this? Okay, I got to go back. See, what happens is I'm using my phone, and then when a call comes in, it just cuts off the website. All of these are not true at all. And I guess I'm unsure if I should be worried that I have a liar on my hands, or if it's a stage right before the age of reason, and she will outgrow it. Parents will oftentimes say, is it a stage? Kids go through all kinds of stages, developmental stages, intellectual stages. When they go through behavioral stages or a stage like this, the storytelling stage, for whatever the reason, sometimes they outgrow it. Sometimes they don't. More often, parents talk about behavior stages, a defiant stage. He's gotten defiant. Is this a stage? He's 5 years old. He's never was like this before. Now he's gotten defiant. Is this a stage? They'll say, well, if it is a stage, you can't let it linger because it can become a much longer stage. So you don't want to live with an unpleasant stage. Now, in this case, she's telling wild stories. So she's basically twisting, bending, breaking the truth. I wouldn't call her a liar, Mom says. She a liar. There's really two types of lies. The main one is, I wasn't in the universe when what you're accusing me of happened. Okay, I'm going to try to lie to get out of being held accountable. That's the big one. But the storytelling lies for little kids is right behind it. What I would do here, Mom, let's see what Mom says with this. Are there any healthy ways to help her not fabricate stories that are so out there? It just seems to be getting a little out of hand when parents at school approach me and ask, "Are you really moving to Florida?" Or, "Glad her arm is healed." Almost as if she's convinced her friends, who then tell the parents, it's real. She also at times, okay, here's where we're getting into the main reason for the lie, but not so much with this little girl. She also at times has a hard time telling my husband and I the truth. In other words, okay, I'm going to question you about what you did, and then you're going to deny it. As much as we have tried to set up an environment that she always feels safe to tell us anything, any advice is so appreciated. Well, I'm going to give you any advice here, Mom. First thing on the story. Okay. She tells you a wild story. You look at her. And you say, that didn't happen. Now, do you want to change that and tell me that it didn't happen? Because if you tell me that it did, I know it's not true, and then I'm going to discipline you for lying. And then you put some consequence on, a good one, you know, maybe no privileges the rest of the day. We had a standard consequence for that in our home. You lie about anything, stories, deny you what you did, one automatic 24-hour blackout period. That means all privilege is gone for 1 hour. We got a lot less lying. Or we got a lot less lying that we didn't catch. Okay, so that's a big one. You just tell her, okay, I don't believe what you're telling me. It's too far-fetched. I'm going to give you a chance to say, Mom, that didn't happen. If you don't say that, if she says, no, it really did. It really did happen. Okay, then here's what I'm going to do about it, because that's a lie. And then do something about it. Now, you're worried that she's telling other people. Well, because they're buying into it. If you hear from somebody else, sure glad your little daughter's arm is okay. Why? What did she tell you? Oh, she told little Tiffany that it's broke. Oh, I see. Okay, well, thank you. And then you go confront your daughter. You told your friend that your arm was broken. You know that's not true. So now that's a lie. And here's what we're going to do. He said, I'm getting cut off. All right, I'll check this. And last line here I want to comment on, and then we'll get to a new e-person. I'm Dr. Ray. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining me. Dr. Ray Guarini, program Doctor is In. This e-person Monday. I was talking to a mom here who has a six-year-old daughter who's weaving fabulous tales. And mom is saying, how do we deal with this? And I gave some suggestions before the break. And then this is the latter part of her e-person. She also at times has a hard time telling my husband and I the truth. So I think she's referring to the number one reason kids deny reality. I wasn't in the universe at the time the misconduct occurred. I know nothing about that, Sergeant Schultz would have said. I see nothing. And the parents wonder, okay, what's going on here? I mean, this kid is so convincing in their denial of the truth. I'm wondering if they even know what the truth is. Well, they do. Unless there's a serious psychotic problem. And if there is, you would have a certain bunch of other symptoms that would be kicking in. So the fact that this is isolated to when you confront me with my misconduct, I don't tell you the truth about it, I stall, I lie, you bring out the white lights, You shine them in my face, and I still cling. Because you don't have any proof. And as long as you don't have any proof, I got a chance of getting out of here. Okay. As much as we have tried to set up an environment that she always feels safe to tell us anything, to get a child to admit to misconduct, some parents will say, if you tell me the truth, I won't punish you. There'll be no punishment. Now, thinking back on my childhood, if my mother offered me that option, I'd make something up. Well, the reason that I did that to her is because one time she looked at me and she just burped straight into my face and I smelled it and it was really awful. I make something up. Right. Plausible. Of course, make sure my sister's not around so she can't deny it on the spot. She can deny it later. But then they'll figure she's denying. So, double whammy. What I usually advise parents to do is something like this. I know what happened. I know what the truth is. If you tell me the truth, here's what I'm going to do. And then you realize some consequence, whether it's go to your room, go to bed early, write some sentences, loss of three privileges, whatever you choose. If you don't tell me the truth, here's what I'm going to do. And then you make the cost for a lie much more expensive. You don't simply try to drag it out of them. You simply say, here's A, here's B. Please tell me the truth, here's what I'm going to do. Don't tell me the truth, here's what I'm going to do. Now, think carefully about your answer, because I am only going to ask one more time. Did you do X? Or did you not do X? Was it you who carved your initials into our vinyl siding one day after we put it up? And then accept the answer. Don't go on. Don't say, now I know that's not true. I know that is not true. We have security cameras, and I ran the tape, and it was you, and I recognized your handwriting, and it was cursive, and you don't write cursive well, so when you scratched it into the vinyl siding, I have all kinds of forensic evidence that, in fact, you were the one. No, don't go on like that. Just simply say, well, I know what the truth is. Now, what if you don't know what the truth is? What if you have a suspicion, but you're not really sure? You have to make a judgment. You can admit it. You can say, I don't know for sure what happened. But here's why I think it was you. And here's what I'm going to do. Now, if I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But because in the past, you have not told me the truth about some other things, it makes me wonder. You see, if you always tell me the truth, then when you tell me something and I think that may not be true, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt because you've always been truthful. If, however, in the past, you haven't been straight with me, then what do you expect me to think? Here's the bad news. This is the really bad news. The thing about a lie is that it works like a slot machine. Slot machines pay off at random. You don't know when they're going to pay off. That's the thing about a lie. You get away with it sometimes because there's no proof or there's not even a preponderance of evidence. So you get away with it. And that can keep that habit going because you're playing for the payoff. Yeah, you may get disciplined for the lie, but every fifth or sixth time, you got away with it. the slot machine paid off. However, the good news is, if you establish the fact that I'm only going to ask you once, here's what I'm going to do for the truth, here's what I'm going to do for the lie, and you make the lie much more expensive, most kids are not dumb. They'll quit playing the slot machine. Not worth it. I'm Dr. Ray.
I don't want to talk about it.
You don't want to talk about it? Then why did you bring it up in the first place?
The doctor will be with you in just a moment.
Heresy is not usually a matter of ignorance. It's a matter of arrogance. We're all ignorant. It's only about different things. And when I hear ignorant people say that they're stupid, my heart just breaks. I mean, to be ignorant is not to be stupid. Ignorance is fairly easy to remedy. It's a matter of learning. And St. Paul tells us to increase in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. He's confident that we can overcome our ignorance of Christ by getting to know Him better. And so he prays for the Colossians. We constantly pray that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, and lead a life worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to Him, and to be fruitful in every good work, always increasing in the knowledge of God. Ignorance can be corrected. One has to die to arrogance.
This week, we honor the visionary life and work of Al Cresta on EWTN and Ave Maria Radio.
Is there a universal call to prayer? The Catholic Catechism tells us man is in search of God. God, in the act of creation, called every being into existence from nothingness. Even after man sinned and lost his likeness to God, he remained an image of his Creator and never lost his desire for the one who called him into existence. All religions attest to man's essential search for God. The Catechism points out, however, that God calls us first to that mysterious encounter, prayer. God always initiates. Man's first step in the process is to respond. Prayer is a reciprocal call. Throughout the whole history of salvation, the covenant drama unfolds. The revelation of prayer in the Old Testament comes between the fall and the restoration of man. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Thank you for joining me here. Doctor is in. One more e-person. We are the parents of a 24-year-old son whom we believe is struggling with panic anxiety over work, social, living situations. That's very common, by the way. When you got something that's weighing on you for a long time, the anxiety builds up. And, not unusually, a panic occurs, a panic attack. It spikes. You can't live in chronic anxiety without a panic spike. He's been living on his own for the past 2 years in a rural area about 30 minutes from us. It's on the same property as his grandparents. He has a full-time job, working the field for half a day, and then works from home the rest. His college friends are all out of state. He realizes he needs to get out and socialize and meet people. We're trying to come with ideas on how to do that. Also, he's pondering a possible job change. He's questioning long-term whether to take over the small farm his grandfather currently has on his property that he's living on as a hobby, I guess, not make a living out of it. All this is weighing on him heavily, as everything is intertwined. We've suggested a therapist to help him manage what he's feeling, but he's been reluctant to do so. I struggle with anxiety, and this is taking over my entire life. I think about it all the time, from when I wake up to the time I go to bed, and I feel guilty for enjoying life. Oh, boy. My son is unaware of the effect this is having on me. My husband's equally concerned, but he's better able to separate the emotion from the situation. How can I do that? Well, Mom, as my wife says, we raised people. Meaning, they all have their own approach to life. Some make life much more difficult than it need be. And some flow pretty smoothly through it. All got different temperaments, all got different wirings. as long as you continue to tie your peace to your son's question marks, struggles, anxieties, you will reflect his anxiety. You will. You will have to convince yourself through thinking rationally over and over and over and over about this that he has to make his own decisions. You can help, give guidance if he's willing to listen, but if he's not, then he's a 32-year-old who's making his own direction, and maybe it's a wobbly direction. You feel guilty because you enjoy things? Why are you not allowed to enjoy life? You raised him.
Well, I gave him my genetics, Dr. A. I'm anxious too, and look what happened. Look what I did.
You didn't do that, Mom. And I'm not even so sure that it was genetically all that heavily related. You can't prove it. You can't know it. A lot of young adults, more than ever, according to surveys, are anxious now. What will I do? When am I going to go? What decisions am I going to make? Am I going to meet somebody? All these things. And they weigh on them. And for whatever the reason, they don't navigate these questions well. They agonize over them, which is what you're doing. He said, from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, the only way that is happening is that you are focusing on it. You are in your mind replaying your concerns about your son over and over and over again. And as you do this, the natural response of your body is to get anxious, as though you're convincing yourself there's some kind of danger here. Your body doesn't know any different. It just reacts. Challenge those beliefs. Insert more reasonable thoughts, like, I'll help my son however I can, but I can't change his condition. I can't change his situation. These are decisions he has to make. He may be miserable, but I can't do anything about that either. Well, I don't want my son to be miserable. I want him to be happy. I understand that. But your being miserable does nothing to make him any less miserable. And once you believe that, see, you don't believe that yet. Because if you did, you wouldn't keep feeding yourself all this misery about your son. You're dwelling on it. It's not automatic. Because your son is anxious is not a foregone conclusion that you're going to be anxious. No, you have to cooperate. You have to keep feeding yourself ideas on how terrible and awful this is, that he's struggling and he doesn't feel good about his situation and he's not sure what he wants to do in the future, etc., etc., etc. And you can have reasonable discussions with him if he's willing to do that. You said he's not aware of the effect this is having on me. Would he be shocked? Would he be surprised? Would he say, hey, Ma, it's not that bad. I'm not that miserable. You're exaggerating this. I'm confused. I have anxiety. I'm uncertain. But I'm going to sort through it. Maybe he'll reassure you about that. But if he doesn't, if he says, yeah, I'm just so confused, I don't know, you can say, well, let's put our heads together and see what we can do to solve this, if you want to solve it. See, many people just want to wallow in anxiety. They don't want to solve it. They don't do anything about it. The old country song, you can feel bad if it makes you feel better. Yeah, there's something about us embracing misery and not saying, how can I alter these situations? So, my suggestion, my strong suggestion here, Mom, is you got to reorient your thinking. Right now you're thinking, as long as my son is anxious, I can't be happy. As long as my son is anxious, I have to be anxious. No, you don't. You have to start challenging that kind of thinking, because that thinking is hurting you. And you know, interestingly enough, it's probably in some vague way affecting your relationship with your son, because you're as anxious about him as he is. You don't need two of you being anxious like that. It's an interesting thing about anxiety. We think that it just affects us and there's nothing we can do about it. And the irony is, anxiety is one of the simpler psychological, emotional symptoms to deal with. It really is. But we allow it to rule us rather than challenging it, changing our thinking, and saying more reasonable things like, I'm allowed to be happy. I raised him. These are decisions he's making. This is confusion he's having. I'll help where I can, but I am not going to be miserable about this. And you better convince yourself of that. Otherwise, as long as he's anxious, Mom, you're going to be anxious. Thanks for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. I appreciate the company. Eric Dumont, what you do here, I appreciate that very much, too. Walk with God. You got a good walk with God? Some of that anxiety is, it is going to abate. It is.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.